Eddie, the Collegiate Senior. Chapter 6. The Spring Track Season, Part 1. On the first day back from spring break, the team meets in the arena, ready to get back on the track. The team's first meet is in 1 week, which will have the top 4 teams in the division from last year competing against each other. Clearly a high-profile meet, the results will be somewhat indicative of what can be expected for the remainder of the season. 2 other 4-way meets will also be held on that date. In one of those meets, the middle-ranked 4 teams will be competing against each other. In the third meet, the 4 lowest-ranked teams will be competing and fighting it out to avoid the infamous title of the worst team in the division. That title, as it has in the last 5 years, will likely go to Dr. Gable's team. Walking into the arena where the team is already seated, Mr. Fraser scans the bleachers as he shuffles through a few papers. Seeing Harry Delaney sitting on the bleachers, Mr. Fraser is thinking of the fastest way imaginable to cut him from the team. So is Provost Layton, who is looking over the performance records from the indoor season with Dr. Owens. Dr. Zunday walks in last and stands alongside the other coaches. Mr. Fraser greets the team, announcing, "Good morning. Congratulations again on a great indoor season. Let's see if we can carry your stellar performance over into the outdoor season." The team cheers and claps, indicating to Mr. Fraser that they are ready for the challenge. Mr. Fraser continues, "There are 11 teams in this division that are not very happy with you guys. And there are a few coaches who aren't very happy with me either. That is because we win. Next weekend, when we take first place in the 4-way meet, the other teams will be battling it out for the title of the first loser. Look at what they have to look forward to. How can that be motivating?" The team cheers as if they have already won the meet. Mr. Fraser continues, "Today, I want to specifically address our seniors. But this will eventually apply to all of you, so listen up. I have known many of you now for 8 years. For many of you, this will be your last year competing at the collegiate level. Listen to me carefully. If you are a senior, you have taken enough courses and passed enough tests to get a diploma that tells the world that you have taken enough courses and passed enough tests to get that diploma. The problem is that piece of paper that they call a diploma will get you absolutely nowhere in life unless you have the drive to succeed." Mr. Fraser then elaborates, announcing, "Let me ask you this. What is harder to obtain? A diploma or a gold medal in the 100-meter dash? A diploma or a gold medal in the 400-meter dash? A diploma or a gold medal in the 1,500-meter run? I hope you get the picture. You can literally sleep your way through most universities and get a diploma. You cannot sleep through your training here and expect to win. And you cannot sleep your way through the rest of your life and expect to succeed." Making a parallel, Mr. Fraser explains, "Your diploma is your ticket to the track of the working world. But your diploma is absolutely no guarantee that you will succeed. What have I been teaching you for the last few years? In a race, there is only one winner. One winner. If you come in second place, congratulations. You are the first loser. You must attack your opponent with no fear. Who here has not heard me say this over and over again?" The room falls silent. Everyone on the team has heard this from Mr. Fraser many times. Citing one example of what he is trying to get the seniors to understand, Mr. Fraser explains, "Now, some of you, when you graduate, will be in sales. If you are working with the customer and get them to sign the sales contract, congratulations. You won. You came in first place. Instead of getting a gold medal, your reward is your commission. Let me ask you this. What does the salesman who comes in second place get?" After a few seconds of silence, Mr. Fraser exclaims, "Nothing. Absolutely nothing. This is exactly what I've been trying to get through to everyone. Second place in the working world will get you absolutely nothing. In sales, there is only one winner. And on the track, there is only one winner. Citing another example, Mr. Fraser explains, if you are graduating and are expecting to land a white-collar job, you will be up for promotion someday. If you have 9 co-workers and only one person will be promoted, there will be 9 losers and only one winner. I can assure you this. The winner who receives the promotion will demonstrate the trait of having no fear. The winner will demonstrate confidence. The winner is someone who will not settle for second place. Continuing with his discourse, Mr. Fraser tells the team, when you applied to this university, why were you picked? You were picked because you are a winner. When you apply for a job, why would a prospective employer pick you over the other candidates? They will pick you for your high confidence level. They will pick you because you demonstrate no fear. In a job interview, you may be asked, do you think you are a good fit for the position? Do you seriously think you would get the job if you reply, well, I don't know. I'm not so sure. Of course you won't. If you confidently answer, I don't think you'll find a better candidate than me, then you will get somewhere. As he often does during a team meeting, Mr. Fraser quotes his favorite Bible verse, stating, in the Bible, 1 Corinthians, chapter 9, verse 24, reads, do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you win. There is only one winner on the track. In many instances, in business, there is only one winner. Never be satisfied with second place. Mr. Fraser continues giving advice to the seniors. During Mr. Fraser's address, Provost Layton whispers to Dr. Zunde, I should have Mr. Fraser give the commencement address at graduation this year. Dr. Zunde replies, George certainly has a way to motivate the team. The business world is no different. Like he said, it's the same drive to succeed that leads to success on the track and in business. Provost Layton whispers, George's presentation is certainly a whole lot more eloquent and motivating than some of the intellectual nonsense I've heard over the years. Recalling the indoor season's accomplishments and defining goals for the upcoming season, Mr. Fraser continues motivating the team for another 10 minutes. As he is finishing up, Mr. Fraser announces, I almost forgot. This year, I understand that there is a new policy. I am told that everyone will have to undergo a drug test if you are to compete in intercollegiate athletics. The authorities will be testing you for performance-enhancing drugs and various recreational drugs. Provost Layton whispers to Dr. Zunde, I wasn't aware of such a policy change. Dr. Zunde replies, neither was I. Mr. Fraser concludes, so, if you are taking illicit drugs, do not embarrass me by failing your drug test. Mr. Fraser then instructs the team to head out to the track. As the team walks outside, Provost Layton asks Mr. Fraser, what's this I hear about a new drug policy? I haven't heard about that. Mr. Fraser laughs and replies, there is no new policy. I made that up. And Delaney just headed to the locker room. Provost Layton laughs and tells Mr. Fraser and Dr. Zunde, well, that was certainly an interesting way to cut him from the team. The coaches join the team as they all begin preparing for the first meet. On the track, wanting to see exactly where everyone's performance level is, Mr. Fraser organizes a few time trials. After running their heat, Eddie and Mark walk over to the field area, planning to throw a few field implements. On the way, Eddie mentions to Mark, it's really not the same without Kathy and Paula here. Mark replies, yeah. I know what you mean. They really liven everything up. Seeing Bobby B, with a hammer in his hand, Eddie suggests to Mark, let's go mess with Bobby B. Mark replies, that sounds like a plan. Eddie and Mark arrive at the launching area, where Dr. Zunde tells them, why don't you guys take a few throws with the hammer first? Eddie replies, I think I will. Someone has to show that amateur how it's done. Eddie, of course, was referring to Bobby B, who turns around and tells Eddie, The hammer is the one with the long wire attached to it. Eddie replies, really? I thought we were throwing construction hammers today. Mark comments, I left my hammer in my truck. I guess I'll have to use theirs. Dr. Zunde laughs, now knowing that today will be quite interesting. Eddie takes hold of the hammer and asks Bobby B, which way do I throw it? Bobby B replies, any which way you want. It doesn't matter, which is partially true. The safety cage will catch the hammer if it is inadvertently launched in the wrong direction. Eddie gets onto the pad, recalling the day when Giuseppe Vio Otto broke into his home. Visualizing Vio Otto coming around the corner, Eddie places the hammer into motion. Into a powerful spin, Eddie exclaims, Vio Otto, as he releases the hammer. The hammer soars through the air, landing far into the red zone. Seeing where the hammer landed, Dr. Zunde comments, that about wraps up the season in the hammer. Courtney, the team assistant driving the golf cart today, retrieves the hammer and delivers the measurement, which comes in at 78.50 meters, or 257 feet, 6 inches. Dr. Zunde calmly comments to Eddie, that was a very good throw. If you threw it about 2 meters farther, you'd be right at the record. Eddie yells out to Bobby B, asking him, yo, did it go in the right direction? Realizing that Eddie is now number one in the hammer, Bobby B replies, yeah. That was a lucky throw. You had the wind behind you. Mark takes hold of the hammer next, also hoping to get in a good throw. Eddie heads over to the discus pad to see what he can do. Holding up the discus, Eddie yells out to Bobby B, hey. It looks like the shot put got ran over by a tank. It's been flattened out. Everyone around wonders what has gotten into Eddie today. He's not taking anything seriously at all, and performing quite well. Getting on the discus pad, Eddie patiently waits for Mark to complete his hammer throw. Once Mark's measurement is taken, Eddie gets ready to make his discus throw. Eddie goes into the wind-up. Dr. Zunde watches carefully along with the other field athletes. Into the spin, Eddie lets out a loud primal scream as he releases the discus. The discus flies through the air, finding its resting place a little farther than anyone ever expected. Seeing Eddie's throw, Dr. Zunde comments to Bobby B, it looks like I don't have much work to do this year. Courtney retrieves Eddie's discus and delivers the measurement, which comes in at 69.80 meters, or 229 feet. Mark's hammer throw comes in at 75.48 meters, or 247 feet, 7 inches. Mark, however, never had the benefit of being ticked off by Giuseppe Vio Otto, as Eddie once was. Dr. Zunde calmly comments to Eddie and Mark, you guys must have been practicing. Those were very impressive performances. Mark replies, we've been hitting the weights more this year. Eddie built a gym behind his service station. We all work out together occasionally. The rest of practice goes very well for the team. All indications are that, in the upcoming meet, all the medals have already been claimed. On the walk back to the arena, Mr. Fraser tells Provost Layton, Dr. Zunde, and Dr. Owens, this is going to be our best season yet. I'm wondering what's going to happen next year when some of these guys graduate. Dr. Owens offers, when I enter the statistics into the computer, I can run that simulation for you. The simulation will give you our expected performance based upon the stats we have on the other teams versus our team, sans there, and our seniors. Mr. Fraser replies, perfect. I'd really like to see that. Dr. Owens tells the coach, I'll have it for you tomorrow morning. Also preparing for the first meet of the spring season is Mayor Jameson, who has been waiting patiently for the training session to end so that he may speak with Axel Braden. As Braden comes out of the locker room, Mayor Jameson pulls Braden aside, asking, do you have time to talk? Braden replies, yeah. What's up? The mayor suggests, let's go somewhere private. Braden replies, I know just the place. Braden takes the mayor to an area behind the student center where they cannot be seen or heard. The mayor asks Braden, have you given any further consideration to my offer? Braden replies, yes, sir. My wedding is coming up, and I still don't know how I'm gonna pay for my part. Putting a generous offer on the table, the mayor suggests, how does $5,000 sound if you come in second place in the 400-meter race? Braden is silenced, which is quite a miracle in itself. Braden then tells the mayor, you got a deal. That's gonna give me and Wendy the best honeymoon I can imagine. Braden and the mayor shake hands, sealing the deal. Mayor Jameson writes the check and hands it to Braden. Braden mentions to the mayor, ain't no one gonna believe it if I don't win that race on Saturday. When I leave the blocks, I'm gonna have to pretend to trip and stumble or something. They'll believe that. The mayor replies, that's really good thinking. I'm impressed. The mayor heads out for the day, planning to make a huge fortune with the inside information he has orchestrated. What Mayor Jameson does not know is that Braden and Wendy have found a house in the town in which they grew up and will be closing on it soon. And, best of all, they will be paying cash, using the money Braden made in the stock market following Eddie's advice. What else the mayor does not know is that the $5,000 check will be turned over to Officer Hayes as evidence and will never be cashed. The day of the four-way meet arrives, which is held at the university's stadium. In the stands today is Mayor Jameson, who wants a front row seat when payday arrives. The mayor has purchased another document with inside information from Mr. Finley, which will represent the likely outcome of the meet. Except for, perhaps, the results of the 400-meter dash, which Mayor Jameson has negotiated himself as a side deal. Also in the stands today is Officer Hayes, who is very interested to see the outcome of the 400-meter dash. And down on the field is the undercover officer playing the part of Jackson Finley. Mr. Finley's two bodyguards, Tony and Dino, are in the stands, seated a few rows behind Mayor Jameson. They will be keeping the mayor under close surveillance. And sitting alongside the team on the university's team bench, by special invitation, is Kathy and Paula. The meet gets underway with the call for the 100-meter dash preliminaries. Eddie, Mark, and Hoffa head to the starting blocks, whose presence suggests to the opposition that the event is already over. As the contestants are getting ready, Mr. Finley walks over to Mr. Fraser, striking up a conversation. The conversation is purely for the benefit of Mayor Jameson, who is sitting in the stands. Mr. Finley clearly wants the mayor to know that he is present, giving the impression that, as in each meet, he calls the shots. Kathy and Paula watch the 100-meter dash from the bench as the gun is fired. Kathy yells out, "Go, Eddie!" Paula yells out, "Go, Mark!" If Tessa was present today, she would be cheering for Hoffa. But Tessa is on the other side of campus, competing in a swimming meet at the moment. At the finish line, there are no surprises. Eddie, Mark, and Hoffa have all earned the right to compete in the 100-meter dash final. Later in the morning, the call is made for the 400-meter dash. Mr. Fraser walks over to Braden, Hill, and John, telling them, good luck. Give it your best. The three runners head to the blocks, expecting to sweep the event. Mr. Finley again walks over to speak with Mr. Fraser, which goes relatively unnoticed by everyone in the stands, except for Mayor Jameson. As the first heat of the 400-meter dash is about to get underway, Braden, the world record holder in this event, waves to the crowd, giving the distinct impression that he is out to win. Braden clearly displays his confidence, chanting and dancing as he approaches the blocks. Braden, the favorite in this race, gets behind the blocks in lane 1. In lane 2 is John, and in lane 3 is Hill. The runners get set in the blocks, and the gun is fired. Braden is off to a great start, leading Mayor Jameson to conclude that his insider, Braden, has changed his strategy. Going into the first curve, Braden is in the lead. In the back straightaway, Braden still has a significant lead. John is in second place, but Hill is about to argue that point. Coming out of the final curve, Hill pulls slightly ahead of John. At the finish line, Braden, the master of the track, crosses the finish line first, winning the race with a time of 44.03 seconds. In what appears to be a tie, Hill takes second place, and John takes third place. Braden jogs off his run, waving to the crowd, glancing up into the stands where Mayor Jameson is seated. The mayor, however, does not see Braden. The mayor is too busy having a temper tantrum, hammering his fist into his knee and mumbling obscenities. A videographer, working for the police department, catches Mayor Jameson's reaction to Braden's victory on tape, which will later be used as evidence against him in court. The rest of the meet goes well for the university. Winning the gold, silver, and bronze medal in every event, Mr. Fraser is confident that he will have a winning season. At the bench, the team celebrates their victory as the medals are distributed. And, during the ceremony, off to the side, Braden is fitted with a wire by Officer Hayes, who fully expects Braden to have an interesting encounter with Mayor Jameson sometime before the afternoon is over. After the closing ceremony, Mayor Jameson comes down from the stands, seeking out Braden. Braden, intentionally making himself available, is expecting the mayor's arrival. As sure as the sun rose this morning, Mayor Jameson, finding an opportune moment, walks over to Braden, angrily telling him, "You were supposed to lose the 400-meter race. What happened to second place?" As he was instructed to reply, and acting a bit on the dumb side, Braden answers, "I'm sorry about that. There's been a change in plans. My other boss, Mr. Finley, told me I had to win today." The mayor exclaims, "What? Mr. Finley? Do you work for him?" Braden replies, "Yeah. In a way." Mayor Jameson hastily asks, "When did you start working for Mr. Finley?" Braden explains, "I worked for him a few years ago, but I got out. Nobody knew about it. He told me that he needs me back in the loop." Sweat begins to fall from the mayor's face as he paces back and forth, trying to figure out what to do or say next. Trying to come to his senses, Mayor Jameson asks Braden, "Do you have any idea how much this is going to cost me?" Braden replies, "I don't know. But they tell me nobody double-crosses Mr. Finley." Now off script, Braden then offers, "If you want, I'll give you your $5,000 back." Mayor Jameson exclaims, "I don't want my $5,000 back. That's a drop in the bucket compared to what I have to pay out." Adding to the evidence pile, Braden wants to smile, but he can't for obvious reasons. Mr. Finley, accompanied by Tony and Dino, walks over to Braden and Mayor Jameson. Opening his vest and displaying a gun, Mr. Finley announces, "We're all going for a walk. Follow me." Mr. Finley leads the way. Braden and the mayor follow Mr. Finley. Tony and Dino follow behind the mayor as they all head to Mr. Finley's limousine. The mayor, as he is sweating profusely, asks, "What's this all about?" Mr. Finley stops, turns around, and replies, "There will be no questions until I say there will be questions. Am I understood?" The mayor nods and wipes his forehead, suspecting that he might be in some sort of trouble. Mr. Finley and his entourage get into his limousine, with Mayor Jameson reluctantly joining them. During the drive, and still acting a bit dumb, Braden asks, "Is someone gonna tell me where we're going?" Mr. Finley replies, "You'll find out soon enough." Fully aware of the plan, Braden knows exactly where the limousine is headed. On the way, Braden requests a glass of water, which Mr. Finley is glad to provide for him. Braden asks, "Do you got anything else in that refrigerator?" Mr. Finley tells Braden, "Please, help yourself to whatever you want." Braden is happy to get a few freebies on the way. Not much else is said during the 15-mile car ride, worrying Mayor Jameson even more. The limousine drives into the parking lot of a marina. Mr. Finley gets out, instructing everyone, "Please follow me." Walking up to a boat, Mr. Finley tells everyone, "We're all going for a boat ride." As they enter the 50-foot yacht, the captain tells everyone, "Please, watch your step." Mayor Jameson asks Mr. Finley, "Can you tell me where you're taking us?" Mr. Finley replies, "You just got on a boat. You're going on a boat ride. Please, make yourself comfortable." Braden takes a seat, sitting back, waiting to see what happens next. Braden made it known that he wished he was along on the ride when they took Dean Grimsby away. This trip is not going to be too much different. The mayor is at a loss to understand why Braden is so relaxed. The mayor concludes that Braden is just a really dumb athlete and doesn't understand the kind of people he is dealing with. The boat leaves port, and Mr. Finley announces, "I want to know what's going on here." Neither Braden nor Mayor Finley answers the question, prompting Mr. Finley to announce, "Wow. No one knows. That's surprising. Let me get more specific. Mr. Braden, did Mr. Jameson pay you $5,000 to come in second place in the 400-meter dash?" Braden replies, "Yes, sir. $5,000. Mayor Jameson cannot figure out how Braden could be so stupid as to answer Mr. Finley's question with such honesty. Mr. Finley asks Mayor Jameson, "Did you pay Mr. Braden $5,000 to come in second place in the 400-meter dash?" Evading the question, the mayor replies with a quiver in his voice, "I was trying to get Braden on the inside for you." Mr. Finley reminds the mayor, "My question was, did you pay Mr. Braden $5,000 to come in second place in the 400-meter dash? Please answer my question either yes or no." With his hands now shaking, the mayor reluctantly replies, "Yes. But I was making a little side deal to get him on the inside. I was doing it for you." Mr. Finley hammers his fist on the table, exclaiming, "Your little side deal could have cost me tens of thousands of dollars." Mayor Jameson now fully understands Mr. Finley's concern. Mr. Finley then explains to Mayor Jameson, "Let's get something straight. I run the show around here, not you. You screwed up. Am I clear?" The mayor replies, "Yes, sir." Now that it is clearly understood who is the boss, Mr. Finley tells the mayor, "I am going to ask you a few questions. I suggest you answer them. Am I understood?" Mayor Jameson replies, "Yes, sir." Tony takes a seat behind the mayor, where the mayor cannot see him, ready to take notes. Beginning his question and answer session, Mr. Finley asks Mayor Jameson, "Tell me, who are the principals in your organization?" Mr. Finley replies, "I'd really rather not reveal that information." Mr. Finley gives the mayor a long, hard stare and snaps his fingers. Tony and Dino stand up as Mr. Finley points to a cement block laying on the deck. Braden sits back, relaxing, wondering what is going on. Dino forces Mayor Jameson's feet through the holes in the cement block and handcuffs his feet together. The mayor puts up a bit of a struggle, but to no avail. Now extremely worried, the mayor begins to sweat profusely. Out on a boat, cement blocks are used to ensure that someone sinks to the bottom of the ocean where they'll never be found, and not for building. Giving Mayor Jameson some advice, Mr. Finley calmly informs the mayor, "Let's get something straight here. I ask the questions, and you answer them. If you don't answer my questions, the next thing on the agenda is Tony and Dino, here, are going to give you a swimming lesson, if you know what I mean. Now, who are your main men?" Trying to recover from his panic attack, the mayor replies, "Okay, okay. At the top, there's Scott McCutcheon, Brad Evans, and a few people at Northside High School." In absolutely no rush for time, Mr. Finley replies, "Good. Now, we're getting somewhere." Mr. Finley instructs Mayor Jameson, "Tell me who at Northside High School is involved in your gambling organization." The mayor asks, "Why do you want to know that?" Mr. Finley pauses for a moment, shakes his head, and replies, "I really hope you can swim. We're 2 miles from shore. It's a long way back, if you even make it." Even Mayor Jameson knows he will never make it back to shore should he be thrown overboard. Mr. Finley snaps his fingers, prompting Tony and Dino to stand up and grab the mayor by the arms. Mr. Finley tells Mayor Jameson, "It was nice meeting you." Tony and Dino lift the mayor off his seat. The mayor, now in fear for his life, immediately exclaims, "Okay. Okay. I'll tell you." The mayor is allowed to sit once again. Off script, Braden advises Mayor Jameson, "It sounds like to me that your ass had better be answering his questions. It don't look like to me that these guys are messing around." Mayor Jameson is now totally convinced that Braden is nothing more than a really dumb athlete. Believing that Braden is also in trouble with Mr. Finley, Mayor Jameson completely forgets that Braden is also a police officer. But Mayor Finley is in the middle of an amygdala hijack and is operating in fight or flight mode. When in fight or flight mode, logical reasoning is displaced by survival instincts. Following another pause, Mr. Finley asks, "Now, where were we?" "Oh, yeah. Who at Northside High School is involved with your organization?" Now very cooperative, Mayor Jameson replies, "At the high school, Shapiro is at the top. And there's a Brian, Harrison, and Ryan." Mr. Finley asks, "Is there anyone else at Northside High School?" The mayor replies, "Not that I have knowledge of." The mayor's last answer is a lie. Barbara has discovered that other teachers at the high school are also involved in rigging events by failing athletes, all under the direction of Mr. Brian. Mr. Finley asks Mayor Jameson, "How does Brad Evans fit in?" Sounding very stressed, Mayor Jameson replies, "He's my main man in the field. He finds agents and makes deliveries." Clearing up the mayor's vague answer, Mr. Finley asks, "So, Evans is a runner. He transports cash to and from the bookies." The mayor replies, "Yes. He also does a few other jobs for me." Mr. Finley asks, "Like what? What are you talking about? Give me an example." Mayor Jameson replies, "He's a scout. He spies on teams for me." Mayor Jameson's answer regarding Evans' role is exactly what Mr. Fraser has discovered. No mention is made of Dr. Nicholson, which is puzzling to Mr. Finley. Mr. Finley announces to Tony and Dino, "Mr. Jameson sounds like he has decided to cooperate." Mr. Finley snaps his fingers and, pointing to the cement block on Mayor Jameson's legs, tells Tony and Dino, "Please, make the mayor a little more comfortable." Dino removes the handcuffs from the mayor's legs, and Tony removes the cement block, placing it back in the corner of the deck. Braden sits back, relaxing and enjoying the show. Thinking he is now off the hook, Mayor Jameson asks, "Why all these questions?" Acting disgusted that the mayor has the nerve to ask anything at all, Mr. Finley pauses and, using the mayor's belligerence to his advantage, replies, "Have you forgotten who asks the questions here?" Mayor Jameson is abruptly silenced, quickly realizing that he is lucky to still be alive. Mr. Finley asks Mayor Jameson, "Let me ask you a question, and I suggest you answer me. What do you know about a guy named Giuseppe Vio Otto?" The mayor immediately replies, "Why do you want to know about him?" Hammering his fist on the table, Mr. Finley exclaims, "Answer me." Fearing that he will be wearing a cement block again, the mayor answers, "He worked for me." Looking puzzled, Mr. Finley asks, "What exactly did Vio Otto do for you?" Mayor Jameson replies, "He pulled off a couple of jobs for me." Getting frustrated, Mr. Finley tells the mayor, "Define jobs." The mayor replies, "He did a few break-ins for me. But Eddie Boganskaya took him out of commission." Quickly making up a story to fit the script, Mr. Finley explains, "We thought Vio Otto was after information about the spring track meets, which was in Eddie's possession. Putting his feet up on the table, Mr. Finley informs the mayor, "And now that I'm thinking about it, Gerhard Zunde's house was also broken into. He also had information about various track meets as well. There seems to be a pattern here." Without being prompted, Mayor Jameson explains to Mr. Finley, "Frank Gloomer pulled off that job. That one didn't end too well either. Gloomer and Vio Otto both worked for me. I can assure you, sir. Gloomer and Vio Otto weren't after any confidential information. They were after valuables, like jewelry, stuff that can be pawned, or sold out of the trunk of a car. Evans also did a few jobs for me." After a long pause, Mr. Finley replies, "Small-time crooks. I see." Braden is surprised at how easy it is for Mr. Finley to extract a full confession out of Mayor Jameson. The cement block could have something to do with the mayor's level of cooperation. Or it could be that Mr. Finley, along with Tony and Dino, represent a threat level far beyond what the mayor can handle. Not being able to see land could also be part of the mayor's forthcomingness with answers. Still puzzling the mayor is Braden, who is sitting back as if he is on vacation on a cruise ship. Staring out into space and thinking, Mr. Finley tells Mayor Jameson, "I don't know what I'm going to do with you, Mr. Jameson." The mayor, shaking in his boots, takes Mr. Finley's statement as bringing into question whether he will live or not. Mayor Jameson stupidly suggests, "I could just get out of gambling, and we can all forget about the whole thing." Mr. Finley replies, "I didn't ask for your suggestions. I'm going to think about this on the way back to shore." The good news is that Mr. Finley's statement suggests to Mayor Jameson that he will still be alive once they get back to shore. Mr. Finley tells Dino, "Tell the captain to bring us back into port. And tell him to take the long way. I'm in no rush." No longer thinking that he is safe, Mayor Jameson takes Mr. Finley's statement, "Tell him to take the long way," to be some sort of coded or secret message. While the mayor is panicking, Mr. Finley, along with Tony, Dino, and Braden, is appearing to enjoy the boat ride. So, Mr. Finley decided that everyone should have an enjoyable afternoon, so he is taking the long way back to port. Tony and Dino get some food out of the refrigerator, and the feast begins. Braden sits back and relaxes in his seat, enjoying the good food. Watching the waves and seeing the distant shoreline, Braden is very relaxed. To Braden, the relaxing late afternoon cruise goes by quickly. For Mayor Jameson, however, each second ticks away as if it were an hour. The mayor is very concerned about his future, or whether he will even have one. Braden walks to the bow of the boat, wanting to take a look around. He is followed by Tony, only for the reason of giving Mayor Jameson the impression that no one walks around the boat without an escort. Braden mentions to Tony, "It's really beautiful out here." Tony replies, "I know. We're finished with business, so enjoy the rest of the ride." Braden whispers to Tony, "That guy really snapped." Tony whispers back, "With these white-collar guys, like the mayor, or Grimsby, when you take them out of their element, they chirp like a songbird. With a guy like Jameson, if you question him down at the station, you'd get nothing out of him. He'd be screaming for an attorney. Out here, no one will hear him." Braden whispers to Tony, "At least, now you guys have a list of who else is involved." Tony whispers back, "The names he rattled off are mostly the little guys. The higher ups, like Shapiro, will probably get a plea bargain if they testify against Jameson. But they'll all do some time." Braden replies, "That's good to hear." Tony and Braden hang out at the bow, enjoying the scenery. The sun begins to set. The captain drives into port, docking the boat. Seeing land gives a great sense of relief to Mayor Jameson, who thought, at one point, he would be lying on the bottom of the ocean. Mr. Finley disembarks, followed by Braden and Mayor Jameson. Tony and Dino disembark last, following the rest of the group very closely. Arriving at his limousine, Mr. Finley tells Mayor Jameson, I hope you enjoyed your afternoon. I have someone I'd like you to meet. The chauffeur opens the door to the limousine, and Officer Richard Hayes steps out. Officer Hayes asks the undercover officer playing the part of Mr. Finley, "Did you enjoy your afternoon?" Mr. Finley replies, "We did. It looks like this case will be closed fairly easily." The boat captain, who is also a police officer, has alerted Officer Hayes ahead of time, by radio, that the operation was a success. If the operation had not been a success, Officer Hayes would have moved on to Plan B. Putting together the events of the afternoon, Mayor Jameson exclaims, "You guys set me up. I demand to speak to an attorney." Officer Hayes replies, "You'll get that chance, but I haven't arrested you yet. So, please calm down." Trying to justify himself, Mayor Jameson points to Braden and exclaims, "How about him? He took a bribe." Officer Hayes laughs and replies, "Officer Braden was part of our undercover operation. The check you wrote to him is in the evidence room." Now that the cat is out of the bag, Braden repeatedly points to his chest, raising his voice, telling Mayor Jameson, "I'm the chief ass kicker. I ain't blowing no race for no one. Not even your flimsy ass. No one is ever gonna say they beat the chief ass kicker. No one's kicking my ass." Mayor Jameson now clearly understands why Braden has been so calm during the boat ride. The undercover officer playing the part of Mr. Finley collects the wires from Braden, Tony, and Dino. Officer Hayes arrests Mayor Jameson, who continues to complain that he's been set up. The mayor is handcuffed, read his rights, and placed in the cage of Officer Hayes' police car. Dino pulls Braden aside and tells him, "When this case goes to court, they might ask you to testify. If they question you about a cement block, you never saw a cement block. You saw a concrete block. If they question you about a concrete block, you never saw a concrete block. You saw a cinder block." Braden laughs and replies, "I get it. Whatever they call it, I call it something else. So, I never saw it." Dino replies, "Exactly." Dino also points out, "While all this was recorded today, if you remember correctly, nothing was ever said about a cement block. The block was just pointed to and fingers were snapped." Braden tells Dino, "I noticed that. Mr. Finley just snapped his fingers, and you guys knew exactly what to do." Stating the obvious, Dino replies, "We've done this a few times before. We took Addison Grimsby on a similar trip. Let's just say he didn't enjoy the afternoon." Officer Hayes drives off, hauling Mayor Jameson off to jail. Braden gets a ride back to campus in the limousine. On the way, the undercover officers and Braden stop and get dinner, and a rather nice one at that. Over dinner, Braden learns a lot about undercover operations. And Mayor Jameson, now in jail, also learned a lot about undercover operations today. Monday morning, bright and early before working hours at the service station, Eddie and Bobby B are discussing the weekend's meet. Bobby B still cannot believe that Eddie won the gold medal in the hammer. But Eddie has been working out in the gym that he has been building behind the service station. So has Bobby B, who will be stepping up his workouts in the next few weeks. Bobby B is not about to let Eddie beat him in the hammer throw during the spring divisional meet. With news that Vinny has found a suitable engine for Bobby B's Volkswagen bus, Bobby B gets to work, removing the engine from the bus he purchased a while ago. And while Bobby B is working, Eddie is performing a tune-up on his MGB. Bobby B yells over to Eddie, "Hey, can you help me with this?" Eddie walks over telling Bobby B, "I thought you were doing all the work." Bobby B replies, "I am. I disconnected everything. Can you check it for me before I drop the engine?" Eddie jokingly replies, "Yeah. But why? If you drop the engine, and there's still a hose or wire still connected somewhere, it will just break." Thinking about Eddie's answer, Bobby B. comments, "Oh, yeah. I guess." Eddie checks over Bobby B.'s work and tells him, "It looks good." Getting a bit worried, Bobby B. asks, "What happens if something is still connected?" Eddie tells Bobby B., "Don't worry about it. Just fall off that bridge when you come to it." As Eddie and Bobby B. are opening up, Officer Richard Hayes drives into the service station, but not in his patrol car. Officer Hayes pulls up to the pumps, needing gas for his automobile and lawn equipment. Eddie walks out and asks, "Did you get a day off?" Richard replies, "I got 3 days off. I put in over 60 hours last week, including Saturday at the meet. Chief Gabriel told me to take 3 days of comp time, so I jumped on it. The pool is almost finished, and I'm going to be getting the yard ready for summer." After filling his gas tanks, Richard, Eddie, and Bobby B. sit in the office and talk for a while. Eddie asks, "I heard you guys busted Mayor Jameson. How did that go?" Richard replies, "We did. That guy tweeted like a songbird. The undercover guys did a great job. They took this Jameson character out on a boat a few miles offshore and had him convinced that, if he didn't talk, he'll become part of the ocean floor. This one wasn't too hard to put together." Eddie tells Richard, "I hear Braden had a nice afternoon. But we ran relay drills this morning, so I didn't get to talk to him too much." Richard replies, "Yeah. He really wanted to be in on that operation. I hear he really enjoyed the afternoon." Eddie asks, "So, who else was involved?" Richard replies, "You'll never believe this. At your old high school, there's Shapiro, O'Brien, Harrison, and Ryan. We'll be taking them in soon. We left them out there after we busted Maurice Crum, simply to see who they connect with. Oh, and this Scott McCrutchen character, the father, is being taken in this morning, probably as we speak. He's been under investigation for a few years. We got enough on him to put him away for a while. Even Officer Hayes calls the McCrutchens McCrutchen now." Eddie asks, "How about Brad Evans?" Richard laughs, telling Eddie and Bobby B., "This Brad Evans character. I tell you, that guy is a real piece of work. He was not only involved in gambling, but was supplying his high school track team with drugs. They are taking him in this morning too." Eddie asks, "Is that who McCrutchen got his drugs from?" Richard replies, "We think so. A guy on Evans' high school team landed in the hospital for the same reason, with the same combination of drugs." Bobby B. comments, "You'd think they'd train more instead of taking drugs." Richard replies, "You'd think. But, no. They don't." Proud of the police department's work, Richard then tells Eddie and Bobby B., "You'll never believe this. This Giuseppe Vio Otto character and this Frank Gloomer were working for Mayor Jameson, breaking into houses." Eddie exclaims, "No shit." Richard replies, "The undercover officers managed to get a full confession out of him." Eddie replies, "Good. At least those guys will be off the streets for a while." Richard replies, "Not exactly. This Gloomer character has been discharged from the hospital and has been released on bail. Vio Otto is a different story. He's in a wheelchair. They are both just lucky to be alive." Richard then explains, "This Mayor Jameson character was charging the businesses in the area an environmental impact fee. The checks were made payable to a company called Environmental Impact and were deposited into a personal account of the mayor. Can you believe that? This character opened a business called Environmental Impact, Incorporated. So, all that money that looked like it was going to the government was actually going into his pocket." Eddie asks, "Seriously? How did he get away with that?" Richard replies, "He had someone on the inside working for him." Richard then informs Eddie, "All that money, or what's left of it, will have to be returned. We've locked down all of his bank accounts." Richard then reveals, this Jameson character is about as dumb as they get. He's so dumb, he doesn't have the brains to figure out how dumb he really is. He left trails everywhere. After your lunch meeting with the mayor and the undercover officers, the officers went to the bank with Jameson to get the cash for the list that the undercover officers sold to him. This clown actually withdrew the money from an Environmental Impact Incorporated bank account. But get this. He wrote the check right in front of the undercover officers. The check had the company name right on it. Eddie laughs, commenting, "Yeah. That guy sounds really dumb." Richard reveals it gets worse. We've seen this Jameson character eating lunch a few times with Addison Grimsby. We think Grimsby is trying to leave the country. But his bank accounts have been locked down. So, he has no money. We think Grimsby was using Jameson to start up another gambling ring so he can make a fortune and leave the country before he stands trial. Eddie asks, "Why don't you take Grimsby in again?" Richard replies, "Because, with this Jameson character now out of the picture, Grimsby will lead us to the next gambling ring." Eddie laughs and replies, "That's really ingenious." Eddie informs Richard, "By the way, Jimmy O'Brien bought a new BMW. Richard's eyes open wide and asks, "Oh, really?" Eddie replies, "Yeah. How much do you want to bet the money came from gambling?" Richard replies, "I'm sure it did. Good for him. That character's going to need some good transportation when he's visiting his father in jail." Bobby B. laughs, mentioning, "Maybe Mr. O'Brien and Mr. Crumb will be cellmates." Richard laughs, replying, "We can only hope." Richard informs Eddie and Bobby B., "From the looks of things, your town is going to need a new mayor." Not quite familiar with politics, Bobby B. asks, "How do we get a new mayor?" Richard explains, "A special election will have to be organized. Then, they'll set a date, and people show up to vote." Eddie asks, "How does someone run for mayor?" Richard explains, "Once the special election is approved, they'd have to file an application with the Board of Elections." Eddie tells Richard, "I want to run for mayor." Richard assures Eddie, "If you run, I can assure you. The police department will endorse you." Eddie nods his head and replies, "I'm thinking about it." Checking the time, Richard says, "Well, I guess I'd better get home and get to work. The more I get done today, the less I have to do for the next 2 days." Eddie replies, "Yeah. Me too." As he is leaving, Richard peers into the service bays and, seeing a Volkswagen bus, asks, "Is that another bus conversion?" Bobby B. replies, "Yeah. This one is mine." Richard comments, "It looks good. I really like the yellow." Richard heads home, and Bobby B. and Eddie get to work, pushing Bobby B.'s bus out of the service bay.